because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind basketballimmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. Excited today to have Matt Woodley with me, assistant coach at Drake University with Coach Darren DeVries. And your resume, coach, it's been tremendous. Obviously, you've been a head coach at a lot of different levels, from the college level, high school level, and pro level in the G League, and assistant coach with so many wonderful coaches as well. So I'm so honored to have you on board, and so many people told me I need to talk to you. So I'm glad to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here. I'm not sure who you talk to, but no, I'm excited. And I think this is such a great platform for all coaches to learn and grow our game, because that's what we're trying to do. Is nobody has the secret sauce. That's why I tell the people that are willing to study and put themselves out there and help other coaches and pay it forward, I think is so tremendous what you're doing. And I've been able to listen to some of your podcasts, and they're awesome. So I'm just excited and honored to be on here with you.
Well, I appreciate that, and thanks. And you know, for me, I'm excited to have a defensive conversation. And let's start with you. I mean, you coach with Tony Bennett at Washington State, and he's the gold standard for defense right now. I think, and in a lot of what he does transfers to a lot of levels of basketball. So, coach, you still buy into that philosophy and the pack line and the different concepts that come with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, when you talk about coach, he really shaped my philosophy when I became a head coach. And obviously, there's a tons of ways to do different things, but you know, what coach has done at Virginia, what we did at Washington State, not always having the best players, so to speak. I always say, like, coach is the best. He's done more with less than probably anybody in the country. And I really think it starts with the defensive end of the floor and the system that they have installed. And, you know, so many of us that have worked for him have broken off, have had similar success.
So the system, we won't get into the exact system, but like in terms of you now having gone on to be a head coach, you've gone on to be a head coach at the professional level,
yep,
and obviously having worked with other coaches, I assume, again, you've adapted parts of the system, you would tweak parts of the system, or would you stay true to the system?
I think the first thing is, you know, 10 years ago, the pick and roll wasn't as prevalent as it is today. So I think anytime you're trying to put together a system, you need to figure out what do you want to do with pick and roll. And to me, it's very simple. You're going to be what I call a show team or a hedge team, or you're going to be an ice or a down or a blue, whatever your terminology is. And then from that point on, you need to then construct your defense accordingly. And I think, obviously, if you watch Virginia, the pack line, we're a show team. We want to funnel everything to the nail, stay out of rotation, so to speak. The hard part about that is when you put two on the ball above the screener, and now you're allowing for a 4-on-3 game. But I think what coach has done is, it's not so much what they do, it's how they do it. And I tell people this all the time is, if your bigs don't have low hands in the screen and roll, it doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to be very successful at it, as an example. So the great thing about my past and where I've been is I've been with great people. I was with Coach Yeager with the Memphis Grizzlies. I was with Coach Fizdale, all these great things in the pro game. But I kept coming back to what we were doing at Washington State and what Tony's done at Virginia. And I've tinkered with everything. I've iced in the D-League. We were a hard show blitz X-out team in college. When I was a head college coach, we were a big-time blitz full rotation when I was a high school coach. So, but at the same time, our philosophy was the same. And we were going to be aggressive on the ball. Because of the pack line, it's one of the few opportunities that you can be really aggressive and putting two on the ball, maybe create an extra turnover. But that's also the fallacy in the pack lines. People say you can't turn people over. Well, look at the turnover rate at Virginia. They're always over 20%. Now, well, and people will say, well, they only caused 12 turnovers. I'm like, well, have you seen their games? There's only 60 possessions in the game. Yeah. They're going to turn you over 12 times. That's like turning a lot of people over 17, 18 times. So the thing what I learned the most with Tony and from his dad as well is the execution of your fundamentals, not the execution of scheme. I think that's so lost and development, not only coaches, but players, is everybody is so caught up in their system that they're not caught up with the basic fundamentals that it takes to play in any kind of system. Because I said this about Tony, is people's like, well, his system work in the NBA. I'm like, well, his system is fundamentally based. So they're going to be sound no matter what they decide to do. And I think that was the biggest thing that I have taken from him, is be simple in your approach and be a master of your fundamentals, because you will be difficult to play against.
My impression, looking at as an offensive coach, looking at how to play against the pack line defense, it takes away double gaps and it forces you to do one dribble kicks.
Correct. Like,
and when we prepare to play against teams that play a pack type of defense, that's our big emphasis that week, is trying to create double gaps and to emphasize to our players to not take that second dribble that you might normally take if there's space. And those are real challenges for an offense. So I get the value of that defensively, that philosophy. Some coaches choose to be a little bit more aggressive, certainly in denial in certain situations. But generally, even at the pro level, there's not that much denial. I was just saying, and I was just going to ask, is that something that you see is true? I mean,
oh, 100%. Because here's the thing. Anytime you overextend your defense, there's two things that are going to happen. Number one, you're going to give up more what I would call restricted area deep paint shots, which is what the analytics tell you is the second best shot in the game besides the free throw. And then you're going to foul more. So anytime you get overextended, you're going to be in constant help and recovery. The way the game's the officiating right now, the freedom of movement from the NBA, which is now being passed to college. And in high school, you can't touch anybody. So now you're going to foul more, and you're going to allow more deep penetration, whether it's a kick out three or at the rim. Well, those are the three shots that you don't want to give up, you know. And number one, you don't want to foul, put people at the line, especially in college, because of our absurd rules with playing 2 20-minute halves, which is just, that's a whole nother conversation. You allow officials to completely dictate the game. So now you're fouling, you're giving up deep penetration, whether it's at the restricted area, which is the second best shot. And then you're allowing kick out, catch and shoot, what I would call step in three. So by playing with the way we play, you watch the NBAs, you're not going to beat anybody that is good. Now, you may beat somebody that's an average to below average team by 40. Well, if is that really what you're trying to encompass with your defense? To me, your defense should be built to beat the best. And to beat the best, you have to be totally sound. You can't be a total help and recover, what I would call two-movement team. You know, a lot of these teams will deny, or they'll be out in the passing lane above the ball, and then when the penetration, they're going to still react to the penetration. That's inevitable. Like, that's just right. Organically, players are going to organically react to the basketball. They're not just going to stand next to their guy unless they've been coached so hard that way. And teams usually do a good job in the corner doing that, which I don't understand that either in college in particular, because it's the same. It's the same shot from the wing that it is from the corner. The one thing you get in the corner is a lot less dribble threes, which obviously limits the number of percentage, you know, going downwards. But I just think it's a really sound way to play. I think you're preparing guys when they get to college to help them go to the professional level. And I've had so many kids in particular, like when I was in the D League for so long, is we'd get these guys from these great programs and they'd have no idea what the low man meant. What are we trying to do? Are we going to, we're just run guys off the line. Well, guys are good now. They'll just pump fake, reload, take one dribble, still shoot a three. And that's people's generalization of how to limit the 3-point percentage. I'm like, guys, the percentages aren't going down. It's the number of attempts. Like, we have to limit the number of attempts. And by running by a guy doesn't limit the number of attempts. And so I guess long story short is I think it's the best way to play, especially if you're trying to win your league. You stay consistent. There's accountability in your program. And I always say this is the guy doing the score clock, your manager who probably has no interest in basketball, when something gets screwed up defensively, if you have a sound system, he should know what got screwed up. And I always tell people, listen, coaches are good at every level. I think Brad Stevens says that there's no monopoly of good coaches at high school, college, pro. I think the pro coaches are the best because they spend the most amount of time on it and they study it. It's their craft. We have so many other things in college and high school that we need to attend to make our programs run. So why would you not study the way the best coaches are playing the game? And I will hear the same comment. Well, they have great players. Well, they're also playing against great players. It's all relative. And so from that standpoint, I think it's the best way to play, to be consistent over a 30-game season. I don't think you should have to tweak much. I hear a lot of this number, 80% system, 20% scouting report. Someone's going to have to explain that to me, Chris, because that doesn't make any sense to me.
I don't know what that means either. But for you guys, like, is it in-game adjustable? Like, you can make in-game adjustments to coverages, or do you stay, generally you stay true? Like, if somebody goes on a scoring run against you guys, like, do you stay true to it, or do you make some adjustments? I mean, I'm not in panic, but in, you know, certain situations that are hurting you.
Well, I think two things. Number one, there has to be data being taken during the game.
Yes.
So someone has to have a chart, because there's nothing more frustrating as a coach. Let's say we're showing on the side and we're going to X out, and they get you with the side pick and roll. They advance it, maybe advance it ahead, and then hit the guy in the roll for a layup, side pick and roll. Well, immediately the head coach is going to say, we're getting killed inside pick and roll at the next timeout. But maybe they have had 3 to 4 other side pick and rolls during that time and they haven't done anything. So maybe they're at 0.75 and we're trying to change side pick and roll. I think the majority of time in high school and college, that is what you see adjustments. People, we got to adjust. We got to switch that. I'm like, no, we don't. First off, they're going to get a tricky play. Other guys are good coaches. They're going to have something lined up, whether it's your post trap or your side pick and roll. But I think the next thing is, how are we doing it? And I always say there's a chronological order of going with adjustments. Number one, we have to do it with better effort. Usually that's the number one case. We just aren't doing what we do with much effort. Number two is we have to do it with better fundamentals. Okay. So if we're showing on the side as an example, and our big has high hands and they keep hitting pocket pass, is that the coverage? Is that the scheme? Or is that the fundamental? So two is fundamental. Number three is very simple. I'm going to take you out of the game. And then number four is then I will make an adjustment to what we're doing. And I've been doing this for 19 years, you know, close to 12 years playing this style of defense, or what we believe. I've very, very rarely gotten to number four. So to answer your question, yeah, there's, I think anytime you play with great fundamentals, you always have the option or the opportunity to adjust. But really, it just boils down to we have to do what we do better. Now, obviously, special player consideration, you know, LeBron James, the best player in your league, there may be some things that you may have to do, may stay with the ball longer and pick and roll, or maybe flood the, shrink the floor a little bit more, bring a guy from the weak side over. I think those are easy adjustments. But to all out change what you're doing throughout a game, I think is just, what have you been doing for 3 months leading up to the first day of practice? Well, your adjustments are made in your practice time.
Right. And it's a great list because, I mean, again, as coaches, like, it's cool to make adjustments, right? To
yeah, say that an adjustment. Well, everybody thinks you're a good coach. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Now, they're now trapping this. So now they're now dropping coverage, or now they're switching. I'm like, no, that's just, that's panic. That's crisis management is what I call it, instead of preventative management.
Right, right. No, that's great. Great way of framing and great list for coaches to refer back to. And, you know, the other part about a defensive system is that, and I feel that way about how we practice as well, but especially about a defensive system, is that you spend less time on scattering reports because ultimately your system, it doesn't matter who you're playing, your system can work against anyone. Again, I'm guessing that's what people are kind of trying to get at with your 80-20, but really, again, I mean, it's your system.
It's your system. I mean, we used to joke all the time of when we were, especially when we were at Washington State, in my time as a Division II head coach, or in the pros, it's a lot less because you're playing 3-4 games a week. Your adjustments aren't more. It's more of just kind of sharpening your axe, so to speak. But, like, are we going to guard a cross screen any different on Thursday than we are Saturday? Are we going to play a rip screen from the wing or a slice cut any differently Thursday than we're going to do Saturday? No, we have to get better at what we're doing. And, you know, the number one thing to me on defense is the number one tenet, obviously, besides guarding the basketball with resistance on the ball, is how do you get on and off the ball? And until you train players and make it a habit of how you get on and off the ball, it doesn't matter what you do. You can have the coolest schemes, make all the little cute edit tapes that you want when it comes to defense. It doesn't matter. Because in college basketball, we did a study, and I want to say it's been a while since I've been involved, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, that less than 15% of the time are teams scoring on their set plays. Yet when I go to a walkthrough or go to a practice, 95% of stuff is where we got to go over this play, this play. I'm like, well, why? Like, why on earth are we walking through America's play when we have precious time? Why not just do something like what I would call, to me, scouting is like, what are the team's triggers? Like, are they a big throwing the ball to the elbow, or what I would call horns down look, or Doc Rivers calls point action, corner split action? Let's work that into our shell drill. Is this a big spread middle pick and roll team with single side tag? Is this a double side tag team? And then you can build all those things into your practice. Who cares if they call it four fist? I don't care. It doesn't matter. Like, it's so irrelevant. Like, did you get their call? I'm like, who cares about their call? It doesn't matter. If I hear left out in the middle of the floor, I know screen and roll is being left. I know this. If I get refused on the pick and roll, we're going to give up a catch and shoot three. I can promise you that. So I don't care if they call one down, two side, razor 10, whatever it may be. It doesn't matter if you play to your fundamentals. Because over 40 minutes, your system, your way of playing is going to cause that opponent to shoot the shots that you're trying to dictate. When you constantly adjust, you're just hoping they miss. And I'm a firm believer in that. And people want to talk about the Virginia, Baltimore County team. They got beat. That was an anomaly. They did go 17-1 in the ACC because of their consistency on one end of the floor.
Right. Any game can be an outlier, and that's true.
Correct.
Look, you and I could go off on this because I 100% agree. And I see this at all levels of basketball. This obsession with scouting reports and just the amount of paper that
makes my head hurt.
Yeah. And again, I get that we all feel like we have to justify our job or do a certain amount of work, or we don't feel good about ourselves. And we think, oh, the reason we lose is because we didn't do this extra film or this extra video or this extra play. And I'm on board. Like, the value is, are your players prepared? And where do we prepare our players so much? We prepare them in practice.
Practice.
And how you practice every day determines your scouting report more than anything.
Well, I said this is, you know, especially working for coach, and it wasn't so much about the system. It was the way that it was implemented is, if you allow a guy to go baseline and you don't stop practice, you don't make that guy, everybody isn't aware, that's no different than blowing a coverage on the scouting report. Yet, at the same time, we'll lose our mind. We covered this 10 times in scouting report. Well, I'm like, hey, man, like, I watch you practice. You let this guy go baseline three times. You let this guy get refused in pick and roll, and nothing happened. I mean, nothing happened. And I'm a firm believer in every coach should have order. And what I mean by having order is kind of like, pardon my language, but kind of your piss off. Like, what makes you mad the most? And listen, I know when the ball's in the left slot and I need to make a one more pass to the left corner, I should pass it with my left hand. But if a guy doesn't do it with his left hand, I'm not going to lose my mind. Okay? But I know that as a coach. I know that the ball should be shared or a set play. But like, my order, every coach should have an order. It doesn't matter what it is. And that's how you should be as mad as you can be in your order. So if a guy gets to beat baseline in our program, I mean, all hell's going to break loose. If we get refused in pick and roll, all hell's going to break loose. If our big is showing on pick and roll and his hands aren't below his waist and we're not allowing a strike, what I would call a strike, so the guard can't throw the pick and roll, the ball out of pick and roll, make him throw a ball instead of a strike, that's what makes me most mad. Or when we run back in transition, I hear so much talk about, oh, we're a great transition defensive team, yet I come watch your team play, guys already getting back on the raise of the shot that should be getting back, and we don't know how to run back because you're running back at a disadvantage. So if it's one guy, he should run back to the restricted area, what I call it the smile. So he should run back to the smile. If there's two, we should get into a tandem. If there's three, we should build a triangle. If there's four, we should build a shell like what you work on every single day. Yet I run back and people just – our kids are running back. It's not that they don't want to. That's our fault. And so, like, those are the things to me in our order of thinking here that we get the most mad at. And, you know, back to your scouting report thing is we could line any of these teams that I've coached, we could run through 10 set plays of our own. We're going to have some screw-ups. How the heck am we supposed to remember another team's set plays on one day? Like, I can't even get our guys to remember pistols or 21 or delay or something. And I'm like, how do you expect? So take those things. And I think that's what this system or any system of play allows you to be more consistent.
That's some gold there, coach. Thank you. And every coach should have their order. And I think the other part about that is that when you tell your team the things that are going to piss you off in advance of them pissing you off, it's full disclosure, right? So your team knows. And I think that's great consistency of teaching as well, is that your players understand the things
that are going to cause your team to lose. That's it. We're going to tell you straight up, these are what we value. These are the things that we're going to do. And then, as you said, I mean, you've got to coach them and stop them in practice. And I know that's one of my hard things with my new players, is to get them to understand that while we practice, I am going to stop practice in the moment and coach the things that we feel are going to get us beat, or the things that we feel will help us win. And that's a hard lesson for players, because, oh, let me play, coach. What does that mean?
I don't know what that means. Like, we need to get up and down. Well, you have to get up and down with purpose.
Yes.
And you have to get up and down in purpose. And I think, like, from the things that we just talked about, Chris, is, okay, we're going to stop it. And then you got to be able to film practice. You have to be able to film practice. I don't care what level you are. Technology we have nowadays, you can film one end of the floor with your iPhone. I don't want to hear, well, we don't have anybody to film. Go up there and do it yourself. Like, when I was a high school coach, we went up and we didn't have managers. We filmed one side of the floor with an iPad and we put it in iMovie and we showed our guys. Like, you know, as a high school coach, I learned so much about teaching. Is we had about five things that I could get accomplished. And those five things that I just mentioned, and everybody knew in the whole program that this was what's really important. And we became so consistent defensively. Then they start holding each other accountable. Because one thing with us is we're a big one-hand closeout team. We call it sticking the ball with your inside hand or wherever the pass comes from. So if you were to imagine if the ball's at the top of the key, it's being thrown to the right wing, your right hand would be your stick hand. And you have to, I always say, stick his face. If you don't stick his hand, I blow the whistle, we start over. And it's building that habit of bothering that, because you can't go with two hands. That's one thing where Coach and I maybe disagree, is you can't close out with two hands. You have no balance. You can't turn and slide. And I'm not a slide guy. I'm a one slide and turn and run guy. I think that's the best way when you play against great guys that can drive the ball. It's one slide, swivel your hips, turn and run, beat them to the spot. Because you want to beat them to a spot in that range of that shot that you want to force. So many teams slide. I don't think it's very quick. And then all of a sudden, now your low man is coming out from underneath the basket or wherever you're funneling your help from. And now we're putting two on the ball, sometimes overreacting, putting three on the ball. And now that's where our three-point attempts continue to climb. And we want to keep that thing, you know, around 16 to 18 a game if you can.
So many exciting things that I want to ask you about. And clearly this builds into a bunch of questions. But since you mentioned closeout, you mentioned that. Coach, does a closeout matter as much as we make it matter as coaches?
No. And I tell guys all the time, I'm like, listen, we're in a generation of drills. We have like five drills. Like, if you go watch Virginia practice or Truman State or the guys that know what they're doing, like, you got a cool new drill? No, I don't. Like, it's just, closeouts are what they are. They have to be fundamentally based. And what I mean by that is two things. One, how do you want to teach it? Okay. Is it one hand or two hand? Well, you can't do it with two. Okay. Everyone's like, well, what about the quick post feed? Okay. A quick post feed for what? 0.8 on the block, 0.8 points per possession on the block. What's going to get us beat is a catch and shoot three or a blow by for a catch and shoot three outside of your, what I would call your first line of defense. So one thing is, number one, that we do not believe in is, we don't believe in chopping your feet.
Okay.
Chopping your feet. You never do it in the – everyone's like, well, run three quarters, chop your feet. I'm like, okay, you're going to get beat, catch, and shoot, and you're also going to get driven by because there's too much space. Great drivers want space. If you sprint to what I call – we just call sprint to a closeout with your stick hand, then, therefore, you're organically chopping your feet the way they're supposed – you're not just going to, like, run on top of the guy. You're going to break your feet down, but if you start chopping your feet, you got 2 feet off the ground – more times than you need to, you're going to get beat. Study it. I've studied it. I've studied it in college. I've studied it in the pros. Watch Kemba Walker. Watch Klay Thompson. Watch Tyler Johnson. Watch Rodney Magruder, like the Heat guys. They sprint to closeouts, and they're there on airtime, and then they can absorb the first dribble with the slide and then turn and run. That's how it should be done, in our opinion.
So are you saying just run and stop?
Just run, yes, because your feet are going to stop.
Just run and stop.
Run and stop. Like, run, sprint to – and that's why we use the stick hand, because that hand, if you stick his face, is going to organically keep you with proper distance without getting a hand check foul. Now I hear, well, we got to flush these guys off the line. Well, if he's a great shooter and you want to get him off the line, do you know how many times he's practiced the side dribble, the reload, the, you know, the J.J. Redick, the Kyle Korver. J.J. Redick and Kyle Korver, they would prefer for you to run them off the line, or these great shooters in college, because it's getting passed down. They would prefer you to run them off the line so they can get a clean look at the basket, because you just run by them and now – somebody else run to their feet. If they drive it, okay, you get a hand check foul. What's the worst thing that happens? You take the ball out of bounds, or they get a 1-on-1. It's not 3 points. The value of that catch and shoot three, which is the third highest shot, what the analytics say, and that's true. Like, it's the highest shot. Like, here, Chris, like, I have this chart I give our players all the time of, it's an effective field goal chart. And every year I give this to what the previous year was, and people always talk about you don't want to give up corner threes. Well, I understand that. The reason corner threes, in my opinion, are so highly valued is because there's no dribbles. If you go from a break and above, you guys play a great game up there. So we're still in the archaic age of college basketball right now. I mean, don't get me started on the rules.
We play FIBA, so yes.
Yeah, it's great rules. So, but anyway, and then sharing this information with your players. Like, I always tell guys, like, if – I help and recover, you know, whether I tag or – now, we never play one-on-one, just hand the ball. We're always going to play one-on-one from a help situation. That's our drills. Like, whether it's a single-side tag, a double-side tag, corner help, we're going to shrink the floor, those type of things. So we constantly are working on sprinting to our closeout. We never say chop your feet. Certain guys do it. You know who you're guarding. To me, that's scouting report. Like, the one thing about a scouting report is the type of players that you're going to play against. And we're not a big switching team. So now a lot of teams like to switch 1-4 pick and roll. That just puts you in, which is a good way to play. I'm fine. That's a good way to play, is now you're going to be guarding multiple guys. And to me, that I would spend the majority of my time in scouting reports on how I want to close out on a particular player.
Oh, that's great. And again, coming back to closeouts again, run and stop, absorb the first step. Are we leaving our feet to challenge, coach? That's another thing that people get into a lot. Are we leaving our feet to challenge or not?
Yes. And it's a very simple philosophy is, and it's something that, again, it goes in your order, is second jumper, whether it's on the drive, and he shot fakes. We want to be the second jumper. We want to be the second jumper on the perimeter. Great players right now, great shooters. Guys play better nowadays. Like, they're just better players. There's better players than they were 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago. Guys are more skilled with the ball in their hand, and they're better shooters. So you have to be able to bother your shot. And now, for me, it's not that big of a deal if we get a contested hand up. But I would prefer for you to be the second jumper. Yes. And second jumper is everywhere. So I don't want to say you can't leave your feet on a perimeter shot, but when he drives in there and he tries to finish, or has an intermediate finish, or he has a one dribble mid-range pull up, you always want to leave your feet, be second jumper.
So the closeout situation is one of those things that I would ask my strength coach, like, how are you teaching guys to run and stop? Because ultimately, they're the ones that are teaching them the physical movement. And that's all we're talking about with a closeout. Now, obviously, the basketball technique is you want the one hand out. But really, the physical activity is what is our strength coach teaching them to run and stop. And I would say that by and large, it would back up. And I haven't done this with enough coaches to really answer the question. So
sure,
you can start and answer with your strength coach. But I'm sure they wouldn't tell them to go choppy steps.
No. When we started this project, this research project, years ago, we did it with an NBA strength coach. You know, I was in Memphis and with the Grizzlies during all the off seasons and the player development piece. And those guys kept talking about, you can't chop your feet. And I'm sitting there my first time there. I'm like, what are they talking about? Right. Well, then when you start studying it, it's like I always tell people, like, when I went to pro basketball, it was like getting my PhD. So all the details. And then you start watching guys, they're closing out better. They're defending the three better. And what the craziest part was is we guarded the ball way, way, way better. So then I started looking at college, and I started going back and looking at the teams that I had, because I taught the choppy feet, the two-hand closeout. And it was, we were just doing it to do it.
Beyond that, coach, it's what was taught. It's how we were taught. And
we were taught.
It's a historical norm, so that's why we were teaching it. But nobody really, again, connected it back to what would an athletic development coach teach. So
the guy that's the master of this, not like we're not even resident experts as coaches on these type of things. And then we talked about closing out and then one slide and turn and run to guard the basketball. And so, like, all those things were studied. They were well thought out. That's how the game's taught, you know, at the top, at the highest level, playing against the best players. And it's all relative. So, you know, you don't want to chop your feet, because organically you're going to chop your feet in the proper way. You're not just going to run and, like, stand next to the guy. Like, you're breaking yourself down. But when you start chopping your feet, you put 2 feet in the air, you have no way. You're not pushing the ball anywhere. You're not forcing him into the area that you want him to force. You're just hoping that they'll take one dribble to 16 feet and pull up, and then you've won, because it's a horrific shot per value. Barely, it's not even made at the 40% mark. So, yeah, you want to sprint to your closeouts with the stick hand.
I don't want coaches to miss this, because you said something in that flow there that I think is extremely important, and that is one slide, turn and run.
Turn and run.
One slide, turn and run.
Turn
again,
and run.
This obsession with slides. Slides don't exist in the modern game. Because when I watch players,
they don't do it.
It's not natural. They don't do it. No matter what you coach, when you say, okay, we got to work on slides, they don't do it. They run and slide. No.
Well, it goes run. Yeah, and it goes back to studying. Are you studying the game? Do you study the game? Do you have off-season projects? Are you studying the way development is going? The game's changing, but are we changing on how we're developing our players? And you have to study the game to watch the game. And when you watch these guys, they take one slide, then they turn and run. And that's the way it is. It's kind of like the 3-point shot. You know, is it that high of value? And teams like, well, there's still a lot of merit into a one dribble pull up or a post up game. I'm like, no, there's not. There's really not, unless it's the last minute of the game or you just need a quality shot. And, like, it's either adapt or die. Coach Fizdale in Memphis would always say either adapt or die. And he was really, you know, this was been 2 years ago when he first came to Memphis, and I'd already been there. We had Zach Randolph and Mark Gasol, you know, the traditional way. When he came, the greatest coaching job I ever saw was he convinced Zach Randolph to be a backup center in the NBA and moved Jamichael Green to be kind of your stretch four to space the floor. And Mark Gasol, I want to say, had taken maybe 12 threes the previous year, ended up taking 100-plus threes, had an all-star year, breakout year. Zach Randolph became almost the sixth man of the year. He punished second unit five men. But, again, his whole thing was with us is we have to adapt or die in this league. And I think that's just – that goes along with all the things that you're trying to teach. And I always had a curious mind. I always wanted to know why. Why are we doing this? And I think you have to teach now in the why and show them video. I have teaching videos of all these things. I'll never ask a player to do something unless I have video evidence. I think it's everything should be data-driven. It's not because, well, so-and-so did this at my previous place. Well, did he do this at your place? And I hear this a lot with, like, these great college programs, and there's so many great college programs. Well, we're not there anymore. And did they win because of that or in spite of that? Like, that's a legitimate question. Like, did you win because of how you did this, or did you win in spite of how you were doing this?
Well, Coach, when I see some of the drills I see sometimes, I know it's in spite of, because and I'm a big proponent of how we teach the game and just some of the evidence that's existed in, you know, skill acquisition and motor learning that hasn't transferred to the basketball coaching world is my big thing. And what you're saying is amazing. Now, the benefit to this conversation for coaches is a lot of them don't have time to study it.
What
we're trying to do is to bring that conversation to them. The one slide, turn and run, I think, is something if any coach takes it away. Just watch your players in their stance covering the ball when someone dribbles or jabs, and they don't do what we teach. And that's so important to be able to go, what are some other things, Coach, that, you know, maybe through your research or your data-driven analysis, or are you thinking that we're spending way too much time on or overemphasizing on defense that doesn't actually happen?
I think number one is the scouting report thing, trying to cover so many things. I think that stuff is really important. And one thing that we've done, we did at Washington State. I did it when I was a high school coach, head college coach. We did it in the pros. Pros is so much easier because the game is very, very similar. You're not going to see a lot of contrasting styles in pro basketball. Everybody is very similar to what they do with some tweaks here and there. But the one thing is, what I would challenge all coaches to do, instead of spending so much time in scouting reports, is come up with — every league is unique in its own way. Like, I could go through, like, the ACC this past year, or other leagues, the Pac-10, the D-League, the NBA, and come up with, within your league, maybe 6 to 8 sets, plays, floppy horns, screen the screener stuff, and develop your own shell drill based upon what you're going to see in your league and use that to start your first day of practice. And if your league is a big horns team, then horns league, then that should be part of your everyday shell drill. Now, I still think shell drill is really important to build habits, but maybe you could have another segment, 6 to 8 minute segment, but maybe you're guarding two actions and you just kind of break those up throughout the time. You're still working on your fundamentals, but then your players get really used to seeing the patterns or whatever your terminology is of what other teams do. I think that's really important. And I also think never play one-on-one from the gap. Like if you're at the top of the key, your guy's on the wing and you just throw it to him and you close out, I think those are less than one a game. You know, usually that ball's getting reversed for a screen and roll for some sort of different action. Work on your one-on-one from pick and roll, because you're going to see it, guys, like hundreds a game. I mean, you're going to get over 100 pick and rolls a game and play from the double side tag. If you're not a big tag team, play from the help, whether you're a low man. Some teams don't tag with the nail guy. They'll tag with what I call the side of two, no matter if it's coming to or away, strong side or weak side.
Coach, we're going to get into that because I love that stuff too, but let's just go back. So you're saying play one-on-one from help, but play one-on-one from help off the ball screen.
Yeah, off pick and roll, because that's where you're going to play one-on-one.
Right, and it could be different at the high school level depending on what teams run in terms of the actions you play against.
Yeah.
But that's great advice to coaches is like, again, I mean, certainly don't just toss out the ball and start one-on-one from that. But it's really hard to simulate real one-on-one, right?
Because
a game, again, a lot of the one-on-one games the way we play. So finding a situation like ball screen, coming off the ball screen, turn the corner, you got to help and recover, then one-on-one. That's what you're saying.
I think that, and then help and recover from different spots, whatever your help and recovery is. You know, if you're a single side tag guy, for example, and what I mean by single side tag is imagine we got, and I know you know what I'm talking about, Chris, is we got a middle pick and roll. We're coming off to the right. We're the only guy on the left side of the floor defensively. There's one guy in the corner. They probably shake up out of the corner, which I don't think you should always do, but that's a whole nother discussion. Maybe he's shaking up. You run in and tag, okay? Are you tagging at the level of your offensive player? Are you going to go and meet the tag? Or however you want to teach your fundamentals and then play that way. We're still going to stick. We're not going to chop our feet. We're not going to get beat baseline. Our help's towards the middle and those type of things. And coach that way one-on-one. You can do that till the cows come home. I don't have any fancy closeout drills. I don't know what they are. Like you're either closing out from a tag, you're either closing out from the nail, not making two movements, or you're either closing out of the corner, not allowing baseline, and do that off of the drills of what you're going to see in the game. And I just think those things are so important and constantly coaching the fundamentals. The other thing that I would do.
Sorry, coach, let me just I try and connect that for coaches and think about your one-on-one drill as a starting point for your 4-on-4 or your 5-on-5. And absolutely. Say, okay, listen, if you're going to play one-on-one from the tag, then that can play, okay, let's play one-on-one into 4-on-4. And think about that way, because any one-on-one drill shouldn't be taken away from the context of how you play or the game that you're going to play. So I think that's outstanding because I easily visualize what you're saying in terms of that being a starting point for us playing a small-sided game, which is one-on-one to 4-on-4. That's how I frame it. Even though it's 4-on-4, it's one-on-one first, and then it becomes 4-on-4.
Yeah, and another one is, like, we'll start with the ball at the top of the key or the left slot, let's say, and we'll negotiate a dribble handoff to the left side. That ball gets swung to a coach. You have to get on, like I talked about earlier, you have to get on to off the ball. So then we'll get off the ball to the nail. The ball will get swung right back immediately into a step up. You have to beat that screen and roll. We play most of our one-on-one. I always call it one-on-one, two-on-two screen and roll. We don't need help. Like if we have great coverage call, if we get into the ball, we don't get refused. We don't allow a strike. We bully the ball. We don't get screened. We can play two-on-two, no matter if you're a show team or a drop team or an ice team. It doesn't really matter what your coverage is or what your protection is, whether you're going to help from the side of one or the side of two. And I just think like those things, if you can get on to off the ball as quick as you can and off the ball to on the ball, those are just those habits that you have to form with your team. And then it doesn't matter what you do. If you want to be this, I've heard this 80-20 deal. I don't know what that means, but like if you want to do 20% of your scouting report, like those things will be easily adjusted.
How to get on and off the ball is something I wanted to come back to as well before we get into single and double side concepts. But obviously you said that's a big emphasis. And then is it your one-on-one stuff that develops that then now that you're playing from help to recovery? Or is it something within your shell? Is it something within just emphasis? But how to get on and off the ball? Do you want to explain that to coaches that maybe don't understand the terminology and then also how you develop that?
Yep, for sure. So, okay, imagine the pack line, 16 feet, 17 feet, 18, whatever people that it's been so lost in translation of what it is. Whatever your pack line is, what we would do is we would start with the guy on the basketball at the top of the key. So imagine me guarding you, Chris, at the top of the key, and you swing the ball to the right wing. It's not a shuffle. It's not a slide. Again, we don't talk about sliding or shuffling. It's so slow. We're going to turn and run one step below the ball inside the pack line. Okay. Now, a lot of coaches are a little bit finicky, whether they want their left foot up, right foot up, or closest foot up, close stance. I want to be in that gap as big and wide and create an illusion as I can. I don't want you to turn and face. I've seen some teams do that. You still have to see ball, you man. That's traditional. I still believe in those things. But you have to be as low and wide as you can. I always talk about ear to chest relationship. Ear should be on that guy's chest. So if he's got the ball in the right wing, your ear should be with his chest and your hands should be spread out as long as they can. And that's how we work to get from on the ball to off the ball. So then we're just going to throw the ball right back. And these are just fundamental, basic, what I would just call deliberate practice habits. You know, your habits of movement, whatever your terminology would be, because you have to form these habits before you throw them out to the wolves and the practice looks like garbage. Okay. Or the game looks like garbage.
So that's how to get off the ball. How are you getting back to the ball?
So now we get on the ball is if we're properly off the ball, one step below, one step closer to the ball than your man, that's our philosophy.
Yeah.
Is then once the ball's thrown back, we are going to stick the ball, sprint to our closeout, don't chop our feet, and then we are going to guard the basketball. And I always tell our guys, like, if you can't guard the ball, okay, with any resistance, your resistance, Chris, may be different than mine. But there has to be resistance. If there isn't, you just can't play. Like, and I get it. Well, what if I don't have anybody? You have five guys that can do that. I don't care your athletic ability. It's just more of a want to and an ability to be completely detailed in your fundamentals on how you want to teach that. So you can resist the ball. And then what we'll do from there is we'll take maybe one dribble, or he may take off on a line, a straight line drive, whatever it may be. You don't want to obviously get beat in a straight line drive. And we're going to slide for that first dribble in case we get the, you know, what I call the counter dribble, you know, maybe a crossover or something. Yeah. And then you're going to turn and run and make force him to pick the ball up. And then what we do, what we call swarm the basketball.
Right.
And we just, you know, what I don't know what the term is. He picks it up. People yell dead, whatever. We're just going to swarm it with our hands in the air. And we're just going to keep walking that guy. We just walk through him. We don't just keep our feet planted when we're in dead. We're going to foul you. Okay. Like that's just, we're going to walk, keep walking through you and swarm the basketball with our hands in the air. And that's just kind of our way of doing it. And then it's built into what you had mentioned earlier, into your shell drill. So as your coach, if you're running shell drill, if they don't get on and off the ball with the sprint, you just start it over. And if they're not where they're supposed to be, you start it over. You put time on the shot clock or your game clock, or if you don't have that, you just count out loud, have somebody do that. I think those things are really, really important to getting – because you can't scrimmage, you can't play, you can't do anything until you get from on and off and off to on.
Right, which is great. And for coaches that listen to me a lot, that's basically moving from block to random practice and, you know, making it more game-like as you go along. So I totally agree. Initial teaching, there's got to be that block component to the two-on-two. But it's live. It's not live, but it's offense versus defense. It's not on air. It's offense versus defense. And there's a live component to that. So, coach, to clarify terminology, so resistance to the ball, you're talking about the player covering the ball, disrupting the ball in some way.
Correct. Yes,
okay.
Correct.
And then when they recover, because you talked about it, to recover below the ball when you move from a position of on the ball to a position of off the ball.
Correct.
When you move from a position off the ball to on the ball, is there some type of below to up movement, or is it direct to the ball? You know, because that's some other thing that I get into conversations with coaches about in terms of your recovery closeout.
this goes back to your fundamentals, Chris, is when you stick the pass, you stick his face. So if I'm at the top of the key, the ball gets thrown to the right wing, I'm now in my gap. Okay. We're creating illusion there. Okay. So now we've eliminated two movements. That's where a lot of this stuff gets screwed up, because teams want to deny the ball be driven. They help and recover. We're not a help and recover team. We're right. a recover team. So when the ball gets thrown back, you take your inside hand, which the way I explain it to kids for the first time is, imagine you're denying your deflect hand. That is now your stick hand. You're going to go stick his face, and we are no baseline outside drive team. Now, when you play from the top of the key, there's a little bit of a gray area, but if you're in the slot, any of the slots, it's no baseline drive, like no outside drive. So we're trying to funnel everything towards the nail to stay out of rotation. We'd rather be a stunting team than a rotation team. So you stick his face, and if you sprint to it, you're going to be in proper technique, proper distance to be able to have resistance on the ball. If you chop your feet, you may be 2 feet off him. He's just going to catch and shoot. Because I know the next question I'm going to get is, what if he just throws it right to him and he catches and shoots? Well, then you didn't sprint. You tried to chop your feet. You didn't move on airtime. You weren't anticipating. Because I hear this a lot too. This irritates me, Chris. This is like a pet peeve is, well, we recruit offense and coach defense. Really? You must be one heck of a coach, because yeah. you have to recruit both. And I think you can improve at the same rate defensively as you can offensively, vice versa. Guys have to want to be a two-way player. And I tell our guys all the time, and I fought this a lot in the D-League, is I'd get a player from a really good school, and he'd be a really talented offensive player, but he didn't want to be a two-way player. And I'd constantly fight with him. I'm like, hey, listen, there's max players on every NBA team. You're not getting called up to shoot threes. You're not. It's the same from high school to college. Like, you get these kids from high school and they come to college or junior college or transfer. Like, we have really good players. Okay, we have guys that can score. The hardest thing for high school players to get onto the floor in college, college to the pros, junior college to college, is to be able to be really sound defensively. If you can get on the floor defensively, your offensive game's going to evolve. But you have to be able to read the help. And, you know, I always tell our guys, when you're reading the tag or you're reading the role and you're the help guy, read the role. If it's not a threatening role, you don't even really need to tag them. Just kind of have be an illusion and ready to close out. So I think by doing these type of things, you're organically teaching your guys how to play defense the right way.
Well, you're teaching them how to make decisions.
Decision-making.
Which is what it all comes back to, and which is sometimes lost when we talk about defenses. Because when someone says decision-making, we think offense. But defensive decision-making is just as important. And Coach, I just want to restate two things that you said. Again, just because I think they're really important for coaches to catch. And that's, you're sticking the face, not the side, which explains everything to a player about what position to get into. Mm-hmm. And then the second part of that is that you're not a help and recovery team. You're a recovery team, which mm-hmm. is also, again, I think what all good defenses try and aspire to, is that you don't need to move in to help. You don't need to reposition to help. You're just moving with all your weight ready to recover. And the best teams do that. So I think those are important for coaches to connect with those ideas.
Chris, can I add one more thing?
Yes,
please. You talked about, like, for coaches, and this is something that I really liked that we started doing when I was a coach at Truman State, is when you're practicing, because we like to convert a lot and, you know, start in a half court set, motion set, is the one thing I would really, really challenge coaches to do. It's really hard. You almost need an assistant to do this, is constantly change your matchups in practice. I think when you continue to guard the same guy for months at a time, which is, we all get into it. Heck, I do. We still play pickup here with coaches. I'm always guarding the same guy. Is guard a different guy. Have a coach every time there's a break on your end, and maybe the coach is huddling up, the head coach is drawing up an offensive play, switch your matchups up. Because one guy inevitably on every team is going to be involved in more screen and roll on the ball. There's going to be two wings that are probably more help side tag guys. Switch your four and five, because some teams like to switch their four and use coverage with their five. Switch those two guys. So guys are developing. It helps your decision making. That's a staple in all of our programs that we've been, is we're constantly changing our matchups and having a coach to do it. That was in my order. I would lose my mind on if we didn't do that. I wouldn't do it in front of the kids, but come on, man. We have to constantly switch these matchups. So these guys are put in different situations, because when we go and do a scout report for the game, Chris, you may be guarding me, but I'm on the wing. but you've been guarding the point guard all week in practice, it's still a different game. The view is different. The help's different. Everything is just different. So I think that's one thing that I would really challenge coaches to do.
Well, that's great and really important for coaches because that's not something players do naturally. They don't do that on their own. But the game is full of cross matchups.
Correct.
And, you know, you have to learn to defend cross matchups. But even if you think positionally, if you do a shell drill, you do up screen, down screen, shell drill, players go to where they're comfortable. So that point guard's only going to earn the point.
Guards go up top, the big's always going to the bottom. I'm just.
And then as we say with block practice, we're talking about block practice with shooting. If we're only shooting from the elbow 10 shots in a row, what our players get good at is shooting from the elbow. They don't get good at the other parts of the game. So that applies to what you're just saying about.
Well, don't shoot at the elbow.
Well, no, don't. I know, but just an example.
No, I get it. I've listened to you enough to know that's why I wanted to.
Just a historical note.
They're going to shoot it in the games.
No, I know. We don't.
And you're going to get beat.
We don't want that. But the point is that you have to coach that in players to not cover the same person and to not go to the same position within your shells or within your defense. So that's awesome. I'm glad you brought that forward. Coach, to end this, and look, doesn't have to end quickly because I know this is going to be a great topic, but single versus double side tags and stuff like that. And I know there's an obsession in the NBA guys I talk to now about that. And and it's great. And it's awesome conversation. And I even pontificated on one podcast with a coach about saying, wow, is there value to trying to get our guys at a really intellectual level beyond what we could do to think about always forcing to a double side? Because it's always an easier help situation from a double side.
Without question.
But is that realistic? Is that something we can always do? Can we always set up our ball screen defense to always tag from the double side? I don't know. What are your thoughts on all this stuff?
Okay, first off, I think the big thing is I think you need to challenge your players to grow their intellectual capacity as much as you can. I think we just always assume, well, they don't know that much or we can't get them there. Like part of our job is to make them grow as players and look at player development, offense, defense, like to see the big picture, to constantly challenge them, show them video, data-driven things, not just your opinion, okay? Because the day and age of, well, this is what I said, this is the, well, I did this 10 years ago with Kobe Bryant, this is good enough. No, that's not. Like, you have to explain the why. So with that being said, I think two things. Number one, when we're talking about pick and roll, because you're getting so much of it, like it's an obsession in game and it's not going away. We can complain all we want about ball movement, player movement, screening and moving. First off, with all the switching going on nowadays, you're going to see a lot less ball movement, player movement. That's just the reality of it is because in order to take advantage and punish the switches, there's got to be some ISO situations, which, I mean, everyone wants to talk about Houston. What they did offensively against Golden State was genius.
Right.
They got the matchup that they wanted. They drove you. They saw where the help was because nobody was moving, and they got catch and shoot threes. They got rim shots, and they got fouled. That's why it went to seven. That's not what Cleveland did. They got LeBron in a switch, and then they loaded up to him, and the personnel wasn't driven. And we can go on and on about those type of things. It's about the shot that you want to get. Okay, so your question, single side, double side. I think, first off, the biggest question that to me, if you answer this question, however you do it, really answers the whole thing. Number one is, how are you going to cover the ball in screen and roll? If you are a drop team, and what I mean by drop or low show, whatever your terminology is, if you're going to sit back and what I would call absorb the roll, I think it's really to your benefit to help from the double side low man to take the roll, regardless if you can force it into that or not. Sometimes organically, it's just going to happen. He's going to be the help guy. Okay.
Right.
So I think if you're a show team and you're a hard hedge team, I think sometimes the easiest pass is to advance it. So if the single side is on that weak side, then that's easier to do, if that makes sense. So either your weak side, single side tag, or the double side tag on the strong side low man.
And what coach is saying organically is that when the ball is going away from the two side in the pick and roll, it's natural for the two side, double side to have the tag. And when it's going towards the double side in the pick and roll, it's not as organic to have
correct
the two side in the pick and roll.
Yep. So, and you see teams down in the NBA like Utah, I think they do a really good job. They're a drop team because they have Gobert and he's terrific and they can veer and whatever, they can do some certain things where they play two by two in that middle pick and roll, but you'll see that low man of the side of two helping a lot because they are a drop team. They take the roll, and that stays away from like the throwback threes off of the shake action to the single side. You cover that up. I think those things are all really good, but I think it all goes back to how you're going to play the ball and pick and roll. If you're a show team, I'd always be weak side. If I was a drop team, I would always be the double side low man would take my role.
No, that's great stuff. It's a great way of framing it and thinking about it. And, you know, again, look, I get that most coaches don't have to make these decisions. Like really, again, at a lot of our levels, this is overthinking it to a certain extent. But as the game evolves, the sophistication of ball screen offense is going to move down.
Well, it's coming.
College to high school, yeah.
Correct. Like, this game is not changing. It's coming. And now the next big thing is I'm trying to anticipate, and I've done a lot of study in this summer, as much as I can with this besides recruiting, is what is the next wave of switch beaters, or how are you going to start attacking the switch, and what are teams going to do against the switch? You see some things like what I would call a ghost screen, like where the guy will fly up and fake the screen and get out of there. Is that a switch? Is that not a switch? And are we going to throw it back to the guy and then throw it right back with a little, what I would call a little head of steam, those type of things? Like, what are we going to see? And I guarantee, I know the majority of NBA teams, I know a lot of guys, like, they're studying the heck out of it this summer. And just turn on the NBA in October and you're going to start, you'll be like, wow, man, that's really good. This is really good. And I think you're going to see a lot of things to beat the switch this year. And maybe, like, things are cyclical. Maybe you're going to go back to the old Pat Riley, Jeff Van Gundy, mid-90s of blitzing everything and making those bigs aggressive.
I heard a coach say that this summer in a conversation, and I think they're thinking that far ahead in a lot of ways. And like you said, they have that committed time and that committed resources and staff to be able to investigate some of those questions that'll bring us some answers. And that's wonderful, because I'm excited to see it too.
No, I'm looking forward to it. And tell guys, young coaches, guys that I've worked with, I've been very fortunate. And, you know, in college, we have so many things pulling at us in different ways, but you have to find time to study the game to help your players become better. And hopefully some of these things that we talked about, and I'm always trying to study and learn from different guys, different people. And your podcast is awesome. Like, this is the only podcast like that truly gets me going, unless Woj has somebody on there like Steve Clifford or somebody like that. So,
well, thank you so much. And Coach, look, I have 3 pages of notes just from this conversation that stimulated my thinking. So I really appreciate you taking the time, and I look forward to meeting you in person soon and being able to watch Drake go through this season as well and seeing how you guys develop your basketball program there. So thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Love what you do for coaches, man. We need more people like you to do this.
Wow, thank you. And again, everyone go check out Coach and the Drake basketball program and support them. Coach, what's your Twitter?
At Coach Woodley.
At Coach Woodley.
Hit me up. I'd be love to talk ball.
Good, good, good. And I know a lot of coaches will take you up on that. So
for sure.
That. Awesome. Okay, thanks, Coach.
All right, buddy. Take care. Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.